Okay.
Well, hello everyone. Hopefully a few more will trickle in the next few minutes. So welcome to this 40th webinar on the secret teachings of all ages by Manly P. Hall. This webinar series, as you know by now, is available on makara.us. Under the subheadings Moria Federation Webinars, then Webinar Series in Progress, previous webinars of this, The Secret Doctrine, and a Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar you wish to view. You can register for the other two webinars on the homepage of moriafederation.com. Okay, last time we finished Pymander, the vision of Hermes, which MPH compiled from these four sources. And with this finishing, we also completed our study of the chapter on Hermes Trismegistus. Though it seemed like a deep dive to us, as you can see, especially from Scott's four-volume Hermetica and GRS Meets Thrice Greatest Hermes, that we really just scratched the surface of what is called the Hermetic wisdom. But in a way, that's what the secret teachings are all about, scratching a lot of surfaces, a kind of table of contents to the ancient wisdom teachings. After Hermes' visions, we did a quick review of an earlier segment on Atlantis, where we learned about the Troano manuscript, which details the end of Atlantis and the immigration of its survivors to the Yucatan, Britain, and especially Egypt. A fitting introduction to the next chapter, entitled The Initiation of the Pyramid, fitting because this only surviving wonder from the ancient world was most likely constructed by these Atlantean immigrants and their progeny. We then touch on information that is encoded in the geometry and alignment of the Great Pyramid, the controversy as to its age, the blind put forth by Herodotus, and the works of three ancient authors about without which we would know little about Egypt's history, especially from this last Diodorus Siculus. We then took a look at the subterranean chamber and the work of two great Egyptologists, Carl Lepsius, who uncovered 67 pyramids and 130 tombs, and Howard Weiss, who discovered the four of the five compartments above the king's chamber. Before we pick up where we left off, let's take a look at the map of the Great Pyramid, which appears on page 43 in the folio edition, entitled Vertical Section Looking West of the Great Pyramid in the Plain of Its Passages, showing the supposed ancient exterior formed by the outer surface of the casing stones, dated 1865. So, could we get a reader for this, please?
Great Pyramid stands upon a limestone plateau at the base of which, according to ancient history, the Nile once flooded, thus supplying a method of transportation for the huge blocks used in its construction. Presuming that the capstone was originally in place, the pyramid is, according to John Taylor, in round figures, 486 feet high. The base of each side is 764 feet long, and the entire structure covers a ground area of more than 13 acres. The Great Pyramid is the only one in the group at Giza. In fact, as far as known, the only one in Egypt that has chambers within the actual body of the pyramid itself, For this reason, it is said to refute the Lepsius law, which asserts that each of these structures is a monument raised over a subterranean chamber in which the ruler is entombed. The pyramid contains four chambers, which in the diagram are lettered K, H, F, F, and O.
Okay, so here are the four chambers. These two are together, which esotericists tell us were originally named after the planets. They are the antechamber, that's here, leading to the king's chamber, which is here. The queen's chamber, which is down below the king's chamber. And the subterranean chamber, which we looked at last time. Let's continue. Can we get a reader?
Karen, can you read that for us, please?
The king's chamber, K, is an oblong apartment 39 feet long, 17 feet wide, and 19 feet high, disregarding fractional parts of a foot in each case, with a flat roof consisting of nine great stones, the largest in the pyramid. Above the king's chamber are five low compartments, L, generally termed construction chambers. In the lowest of these so-called hieroglyphics of the pharaoh Cheops are located. The roof of the fifth construction chamber is peaked. At the end of the king's chamber, opposite the entrance, stands the famous sarcophagus, or coffer, which is L, and behind it is a shallow opening that was dug in the hope of discovering valuables. Two air vents, M and N, passing through the entire body of the pyramid, ventilate the king's chamber. In itself, this is sufficient to establish that the building was not intended for a tomb.
Thank you. And next up, could we get a reader, please?
Yvonne, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. Between the upper end of the Grand Gallery, GG, and the King's Chamber is a small antechamber, H. Its extreme length, 9 feet. Its extreme width, 5 feet. And at extreme height, 12 feet, with its walls grooved for our purposes now, unknown. The groove nearest the Grand Gallery is a slab of stone in two sections with a peculiar boss or knob protruding about an inch from the surface of the upper part facing the Grand Gallery. This stone does not reach to the floor of the antechamber, and those entering the king's chamber must pass under the slab. From the king's chamber, the Grand Gallery, 157 feet in length, 28 feet in height, and 7 feet in width at its widest point, and decreasing to 3.5 feet as the result of seven converging overlaps of the stones forming the walls, descends to a little above the level of the queen's chamber. Here a gallery, E, branches off, passing more than 100 feet back towards the center of the pyramid and opening into the queen's chamber, F.
Okay, you know, this is mostly just a physical description, so there's not a lot to talk about. So we'll just keep going here. Could we get a reader, please?
And Veronica, can you read that for us, please? I don't see you unmuting, Anne Veronica.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Hello.
Hi.
The Queen's Chamber is 19 feet long, 17 feet wide, and 20 feet high. Its roof is peaked and composed of a great slab of stone. Air passages lead from the Queen's Chamber, but these were not open originally. In the east wall of the Queen's Chamber is a peculiar niche of gradually converging stone, which in all likelihood may prove to be a new lost entranceway. At the point where the Grand Gallery ends and the horizontal passage towards the Queen's Chamber begins is the entrance to the well, and also the opening leading down the first ascending passage D, to the point where this passage meets the descending passage A, leading from the outer wall of the pyramid down to the subterranean chamber.
Thank you. And next, we can read her, please.
Vivian, can you read that, please?
The Queen's Chamber is 19 feet long, 17 feet wide.
Wait a minute. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Right. I can't read the top line, I'm afraid. It's covered by... So it's after descending, and then I can't read what's there.
After descending 59 feet down the well.
The grotto is reached. Continuing through the floor of the grotto, the well leads downward 133 feet to the descending entrance passage A, which it meets a short distance before this passage becomes horizontal and leads into the subterranean chamber. The subterranean chamber O is about 46 feet long and 27 feet wide, but is extremely low, the ceiling varying in height from a little over 3 feet to about 13 feet, from the rough and apparently unfinished floor. From the south side of the subterranean chamber, a low tunnel runs about 50 feet and then meets a blank wall. These constitute the only known openings in the pyramid, with the exception of a few niches, exploration holes, blind passages, and the rambling cavernous tunnel B, hewn out by the Muslims under the leadership of the Prophet's descendant, Caliph al-Mamun.
Okay, any thoughts or questions about just this sort of dry description of just the physical aspects of the Great Pyramid? You know, this was the description given underneath the map, and so the orientation is just to be able to find any one of these rooms by means of the map and the description. Anyway, we'll be looking at some of these features in greater depth as we continue.
Francis?
Yeah.
Yvonne's got her hand up.
Yeah, Yvonne. You have to unmute.
Yeah, I'm unmuted, okay. You said there were air passages in the King's Chamber, but not the Queen's Chamber. I find that interesting. And also, I don't understand the well. Is the well actually where they could get down for water? Is it a real well?
No. Yeah, it's a lot of these names are just, you know, like you wonder where they came from. It's sort of well-like is why. Okay, so let's go back. There's the supposed well. It's really just a passage from the upper regions down to the lower regions, and it's not finished out like the other passages are. And let's see. Yeah, here's an example. Here's the grotto shown here. Very rough, right? But we're going to be talking about all this soon, but there was no well for water. And see, and you also asked about, what was your other question about?
It was the King's Passage has two.
Let's go back to it. So yeah. Here are the, you know, I don't think they were ever meant to be air shafts as such. I think they were observation alignments to these observation channels that aligned with certain starry features, and people who have gone back to see just how the stars were at different periods of time historically have hypothesized based on that when the pyramid was built. So when these shafts were aligned to certain stars, then there's going to be a hypothesis that the pyramid was built at that time. So, so you have here, see these shafts weren't even finished. They're just taken up to that level. So that also suggests that it was never meant as an air shaft, even though the king's chamber shafts were complete.
Okay, even if it's meant for alignment with the stars, but they couldn't align from the queen's chamber, she wouldn't be able to see the stars if they weren't.
Exactly, that's right. It's one of the mysteries. You know, it suggests to me anyway that the alignment wasn't ever meant to be by sight, but an energetic alignment by creating this shaft that you brought in that energy. You know, but there's so many things we don't know about this amazing pyramid.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, Tia. I see Tia's hand. Sorry.
To go back where you stopped reading, there was a reference to be here where it says the leadership of the prophet's descendants, Caliph al-Mamun. Was responsible. Was there a spiritual reason that they did that? Do we know why they?
I'm going to be getting to that shortly.
Okay.
Tia. So, the hypothesis that he dug this, it's really a, let's see, where is it? Yeah, here. Dug this channel, what's called the forced entrance, right? This is a 3D. You have to look at this pyramid 3D, and that he dug this entrance in. Certainly would not have been spiritual because it's really a desecration. But there's good evidence that that the caliph didn't do this at all. It's a kind of a, it was originally introduced in the 13th century, this idea, and it kind of caught on that this happened, but there's really no evidence. In fact, there's pretty strong evidence that he didn't dig it. But at MPH's time, it was strongly believed that indeed he dig this. So anybody else, any other questions about this? We're going to be getting into some of these features in more detail. Okay, let's drop back a couple of pages in the text from where the map occurs and continue where we left off last time. Could we get a reader, please?
Eleonora, can you read for us, please?
As the most eminent authorities on the subject are still uncertain as to the true meaning of these crude markings. Whatever proof they might be that the building was erected during the fourth dynasty is certainly offset by the seashells at the base of the pyramid, which Mr. Gobb advances as evidence that it was erected before the deluge, a theory substantiated by the much abused Arabian traditions. One Arabian historian declared that the pyramid was built by the Egyptian sages as a refuge against the flood, while another proclaimed it to have been the treasure house of the powerful King Shaddad bin Ad. A panel of hieroglyphics over the entrance, which the casual observer might consider to afford a solution of the mystery, unfortunately dates back no further than AD 1843, having been cut at that time by Dr. Lipsius as a tribute to the King of Persia.
Thank you. So first, a statement weighing the evidence of the quote crude markings against the seashells found in the building stones of the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx. So 25 years after the Secret Teachings was written, the eminent Egyptologist René Schwaller de Lubitsch speculated that the body of the Sphinx was eroded by deluges and that therefore the Sphinx must belong to a much earlier era. In 1979, author John Anthony West and Professor Robert Schock, inspired by de Lubitsch's ideas, attributed the erosion to Nile floods circa 10,000 years BC. So they agreed with this eminent Egyptologist, really the only Egyptologist that really had a more occult view and was at the same time a working Egyptologist in Egypt. So anyway, can we get a reader for this, please?
Pia, can you read that for us, please?
By denying the existence of any evidence for the development of Egyptian civilization prior to the first dynasty, West created room to inject the idea of a lost, advanced civilization of Atlanteans who created the Sphinx and passed on their knowledge to the dynastic Egyptians. 10 years later, West sought the opinion of geologist Robert Schoch to validate his claims. In 1990, they traveled together to Egypt, visiting the Sphinx. The following year, Shaw formulated and presented his version of the hypothesis, purposely avoiding the use of the word Atlantis. He originally estimated the Sphinx to have been created before 5000 BC, later pushing his minimum estimate further back to 9700 BC, once again aligning it with Plato's lost civilization of Atlantis. Schoch and West argue that other structures and surfaces on the Giza Plateau are made from the same band of limestone as the Sphinx enclosure, but do not show the same erosion as the walls of the Sphinx enclosure.
Thank you. Okay. Anytime you have any questions or thoughts, just raise your hand. So next we have the idea that the Great Pyramid was used as a refuge against the flood, which is impractical since the interior spaces are relatively small. Also, why would the ancients go to such extraordinary lengths to create a geometrically perfect structure merely to act as a refuge against the flood? For the same reason, it is just as unlikely that the Great Pyramid was constructed to be a treasure house. Just, you know, even though there are some large rooms, there would be, if these were the reasons, there would be much easier ways of constructing an edifice. King Shaddad appears in a story from 1001 Nights as the king of all worldly kings. Though it's a bit off topic, let's take a look at this just for the fun of it. Can we get a reader, please?
Kirsten, can you read that for us, please?
Now under his hand were 100,000 kings, each ruling over 100,000 captains, commanding each 100,000 warriors. So he called these all before him and said to them, I find in old books and histories a description of paradise. Is it as it is to be in the next world, and I desire to build it its like in this world. Go ye forth, therefore, to the goodliest and most spacious tract in the world, and build me there a city of gold and silver, whose gravel shall be rubies and chrysolites and pearls, and the columns of its walls beryl?
Yeah, it's a type of precious stone.
Okay.
Yeah. And then finally, MPH's comment on Dr. Lepsius's tribute to the King of Prussia. Here's a painting of Dr. Lepsius and company celebrating King Friedrich Wilhelm IV's birthday atop the Great Pyramid. Remember, it was Lepsius that discovered all those pyramids and tombs. Okay, next up, can we get a reader?
Rod, can you read that for us, please?
Caliph al-Mamun, an illustrious descendant of the Prophet, inspired by stories of the immense treasure sealed within its depths, journeyed from Baghdad to Cairo, AD 820, with a great force of workmen to open the mighty pyramid. when Caliph al-Mamun first reached the foot of the Rock of Ages and gazed up at its smooth, glistening surface, a tumult of emotions undoubtedly racked his soul. The casing stones must have been in place at that time of his visit, but the Caliph could find no indication of an entrance. Four perfectly smooth surfaces confronted him. Following vague rumors, he set his followers to work on the north side of the pyramid, with instructions to keep on cutting and chiseling until they discovered something. To the Muslims, with their crude instruments and vinegar, it was a Herculean effort to tunnel a full 100 feet through the limestone. Many times they were on the point of rebellion, but the word of the Caliph was law, and the hope of a vast fortune buoyed them up.
Okay, let's finish the story. Could we get a reader, please?
Yes. Jane, can you read that for us, please? I don't see Jane unmuting. Joe Garso, can you read that for us, please? Okay, not getting there either.
I'm here.
There you go.
Thank you.
So what are we reading, this page?
Yes, if you're on the right, please, yeah.
Okay. At last, on the eve of total discouragement, fate came to their rescue. A great stone was heard to fall somewhere in the wall near the toiling and disgruntled Arabs. Pushing on toward the sound with renewed enthusiasm, they finally broke into the descending passage, which leads into the subterranean chamber. They then chiseled their way around the great stone portcullis, which had fallen into a position barring their progress, and attacked and removed, one after another, the granite plugs, which for a while continued to slide down the passage leading from the queen's chamber above. Finally, no more blocks descended, and the way was clear for the followers of the prophet. But where were the treasures? From room to room, the frantic workmen rushed, looking in vain for loot. The discontent of the Muslims reached such a height that Caliph al-Mamun, who had inherited much of the wisdom of his illustrious father, the Caliph of Rashid, sent to Baghdad for funds, which he caused to be secretly buried near the entrance of the pyramid. He then ordered his men to dig at that spot, and great was their rejoicing when the treasure was discovered, the workmen being deeply impressed by the wisdom of the antediluvian monarch, who had carefully estimated their wages and thoughtfully caused the exact amount to be buried for their benefit. The Caliph then returned to the city of his fathers, and the Great Pyramid was left to the mercy of succeeding generations.
Great story, isn't it? Totally, almost certainly not true at all. But, you know, in 1926, when this book was written, this was gospel. This is what was believed to be true. There's been a lot of evidence since then, and we'll get into that, that it's not true at all. Nonetheless, Caliph al-Mamun was an incredible individual. He was a polymath, philosopher, an explorer, author. And I especially like this passage from The Meadows of Gold, one of 20 books that he authored. Could we get a reader for this?
Andrea, kind of can
how you... enlightened he was.
Andrea, can you read that
yes,
for?
I can. The sciences were financially supported, honored everywhere, universally pursued. They were like tall edifices supported by strong foundations. Then the Christian religion appeared in Byzantium, and the centers of learning were eliminated. Their vestiges effaced, and the edifice of Greek learning was obliterated. Everything the ancient Greeks had brought to light vanished, and the discoveries of the ancients were altered beyond recognition. The Meadows of Gold by Al-Masudi.
Thank you. So in his article, Inside the Great Pyramid, historian and explorer Mike Dash disputes that the Kalos men ever dug into the pyramid, noting that the story about Amasuti didn't appear until the 13th century, and that the passage made was too well located exactly where the descending and ascending passages converge to be hacked at random. He concludes that it is much more likely that the passage was made at a much earlier date by those who were familiar with the plan of the Great Pyramid. We turn to page 42 in the folio edition to finish the introductory section on the Great Pyramid. Can we get a reader, please?
Rudy, can you read that for us, please?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
In the 9th century, the sun's rays striking the highly polished surfaces of the original casing stones caused each side of the pyramid to appear as a dazzling triangle of light. Since that time, all but two of these casing stones have disappeared. Investigation has resulted in their discovery, recut and resurfaced in the walls of Mohammedan mosques and palaces in various parts of Cairo and its environs.
Thank you. So almost no fragments of these casing stones have been found on the Great Pyramid itself. But the summit of neighboring Khafre, though damaged by erosion, still has its original casing stones. Here are a couple of artist recreations of what the pyramids may have looked like with their casing stones and pyramidions, if they ever existed, intact. Okay, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Martha, can you read that for us, please?
There's a new section called Pyramid Problems. Reader, please.
Yeah, go ahead, Martha.
Thank you very much. C. Piazzi Smith asks, was the Great Pyramid then erected before the invention of hieroglyphics and previous to the birth of the Egyptian religion? Time may yet prove that the upper chambers of the pyramid were a sealed mystery before the establishment of the Egyptian empire. In the subterranean chamber, however, are markings which indicate that the Romans gained admission there. In the light of the secret philosophy of the Egyptian initiates, W.W. Harmon, by a series of extremely complicated yet exact mathematical calculations, determines that the first ceremonial of the pyramid was performed 68,890 years ago on the occasion when the star Vega, for the first time, sent its ray down the descending passage into the pit. The actual building of the pyramid was accomplished in the period of from 10 to 15 years immediately preceding this date.
Thank you, Martha. Okay. First, C. Piazzi Smythe asked, was the Great Pyramid then erected before the invention of hieroglyphics and previous to the birth of the Egyptian religion? Smythe went to Egypt with the sole intent of accurately measuring every angle and dimension of the Great Pyramid. In addition to his measuring equipment, he took a specially designed camera to photograph both the interior and exterior of the pyramid, as well as instruments to determine the pyramid's accurate latitude and longitude. Smythe recorded his observations in the book Our Inheritance in the Great Pyramid. Note the cover design, suggesting the pyramid's base and four triangular sides. Could we get a reader for this? Excerpt.
Okay, but first, Tia's got her hand up.
Yeah, Tia.
I was just going to say the last passage from MPH
it goes to this question that I have. I always thought of the pyramids as just tombs, but it seems that they are actually places where the high ceremonial arts could have been performed or would have been performed. So they may not have actually been sealed, but the initiates, I guess, through the power of sound, were able to unlock them and open them at will, to use them for other purposes besides just as places for the dead.
Well, exactly. First of all, straight archaeology still believes that the Great Pyramid was a tomb, you know, for Cheops or Khufu, depending on how you pronounce that first dynasty pharaoh, right? Occultists, including HPB, and pretty much across the line, occultism believes that it was a chamber of initiation and that it was never a tomb, right? Other pyramids, it's known that they were built much later and were definitely tombs. But the Great Pyramid is singular. It's the only one with upper chambers or chambers within the mass of the pyramid itself. And occultists believe that it was built, first of all, millennia earlier than is suggested by Egyptologists, and was built as a chamber of initiation. DK gets into this in a section after this section on the Sphinx, which is coming up, and then he dives into this these ideas. Thanks, Tia. Anyone else?
No, but you need a reader, right?
I do need a reader.
Okay. Kira, can you read that for us, please?
Oh, wait a minute. We just read that, didn't we? We are here. Hang on. We don't need a reader. Okay, so next up. Time may yet prove that the upper chambers of the pyramid were a sealed mystery before the establishment of the Egyptian Empire, that this whole pyramid existed before what we historically understand to be the Egyptian Empire. The upper chambers are, of course, the king's and queen's chamber. It's astonishing to think of Egyptian civilization rising and falling in the presence of the Great Pyramid and yet remaining unexplored by them. Astonishing, but to my mind, very doubtful. Again, if you think of it as a chamber of initiation, it would have been used all during the Egyptian, including the historical Egyptian period, as such a chamber. So HPB puts forth her own theory on this. And, you know, there's a special relevance to HPB's writings because they're overshadowed by masters of wisdom. So we give a little more credence to this. Could we get a reader, please? A little bit lengthy, but I think it's worth it.
Kira, can you read that for us, please?
Broadly calculated, it is believed by Egyptologists that the Great Pyramid was built 3,350 BC, and that the Menes and his dynasty existed 750 years before the fourth dynasty, supposed to have built the pyramids, had appeared. Thus, 4,100 years BC is the age assigned to Menes. Now, Sir J. Gardner Wilkinson's declaration that all the facts lead to the conclusion that the Egyptians had already made very great progress in the arts of civilization before the age of Menes, and perhaps before they immigrated into the valley of the Nile, is very suggestive as destroying this hypothesis. It points to great civilization in prehistoric times and a still greater antiquity. The Shesu Hor, the the servants of Horus were the people who had settled in Egypt. And as M.G. Mespero affirms, it is to the prehistoric race that belongs the honor of having founded the principle of cities of Egypt and established the most important sanctuaries. This was before the Great Pyramid epoch, and when Egypt had hardly arisen from the waters. Yet they possessed the hieroglyphic form of writing special to the Egyptians and must have been already considerably advanced in civilization. It was, says Lenormant, the country of the great prehistoric sanctuaries, seats of the sacerdotal dominion, which played the most important part in the origin of civilization. What is the date assigned to these people? We hear of 4,000 at the utmost of 5,000 years BC, Mespero. Now it is claimed that it is by means of the cycle of 25,868 years, the sidereal year, that the approximate year of the erection of the Great Pyramids can be ascertained. Assuming that the long, narrow downward passage was directed towards the pole star of the pyramid builders, astronomers have shown that Alpha Draconis, the then pole star, was in the required position about 3,350 BC, as well as in 2,170 BC. But we are also told that this relative position of Alpha Draconis and Alcyon being an extraordinary one, it could not occur again for a whole sidereal year. This demonstrates that since the Dendera zodiac shows the passage of three sidereal years, the Great Pyramid must have been built 78,000 years ago, or in any case, that this possibility deserves to be accepted at least as readily as the later date of 3,350 BC.
Thank you. Any thoughts about this? Okay, back to the text. In the subterranean chamber, however, are markings which indicate that the Romans gained admission there. Here's a photo taken in 1906 that shows the Roman graffiti in the upper right-hand corner.
Oh, yeah.
Next, in the light of the secret philosophy of the Egyptian initiates, W.W. Harmon, by a series of extremely complicated yet exact mathematical calculations, determines that the first ceremonial of the pyramid was performed 68,890 years ago, on the occasion when the star Vega, for the first time, sent its ray down the descending passage into the pit. Now, keep in mind that Harmon's ideas are not based on any archaeological data, but only on computations revealing that Vega was in a particularly strong alignment at that time. In New Light from the Great Pyramid, Albert Parsons put forward another date for the Great Pyramid alignment with Vega. Could we get a reader, please?
That the most remarkable agreement exists between Latch's chronicle epochs and allegories of scripture and the procession of the equinoxes through the signs of the zodiac. When, therefore, Latch, from scriptural premises solely, is led to place the era of the Great Pyramid between 12,098 and 13,046 BC, it is at all events a striking coincidence that at that period, in the place of the inauspicious Alpha Draconis, we would have the brilliant star of the first magnitude called Vega, which ranks fifth among the 15 largest stars known to astronomy.
Thank you, BL. Next, the actual building of the pyramid was accomplished in the period of from 10 to 15 years immediately preceding this date, that date being around 67,000 BC. Here is the date. This puts MPH in agreement with Harman and HPB, roughly speaking. At any rate, we see that a number of authors assert that the Great Pyramid was built millennia before the dates put forward by all but a few modern Egyptologists, most notably among them being Schwaller de Lubitsch. So you have any of your own theories or thoughts on this? I'd love to hear them. You could see the huge, the wide array of dates that we have. Edgar Cayce put it at, I think, 10,600 BC, and there was some alignment at that time, as I'll show in a little bit. So it seems like we have three camps way back in this era, this sort of 70,000 years ago kind of era, and we have Harman and MPH and HPB in that camp. And then we have a number of people such as Anthony Key West and Schock and Edgar Cayce, who put it at about 10,000 BC, way before historical Egypt. And then we have almost all current Egyptologists who put it at about between 2500 and 4000 BC. It seems to be the three camps. Okay. Next up, could we get a reader, please?
Karen, can you read that for us, please?
While such figures doubtless will evoke the ridicule of modern Egyptologists, they are based upon an exhaustive study of the principles of sidereal mechanics as incorporated into the structure of the pyramid by its initiated builders. If the casing stones were in position at the beginning of the 9th century, the so-called erosion marks upon the outside were not due to water. The theory also that the salt upon the interior stones of the pyramid is evidence that the building was once submerged is weakened by the scientific fact that this kind of stone is subject to exudations of salt. While the building may have been submerged, at least in part, during the many thousands of years since its erection, the evidence adduced to prove this point is not conclusive.
Thank you, Karen. Okay, first, while such figures tell us will evoke the ridicule of modern Egyptologists, they are based upon an exhaustive study of the principles of sidereal mechanics as incorporated into the structure of the pyramid by its initiated builders. Okay, the term sidereal mechanics is a method of calculating the precession of the equinoxes, which causes the zodiacal signs to change position relative to the vernal equinox. One precession through the zodiac, called a sidereal or Platonic year, takes, and there's a number of figures on this, one is 25,772. HPB gives a number at 25,800 and something years to complete. This figure divided by 12 is roughly 2,150 years. Notice on this chart that the most common alternate date for the building of the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx lies in either Virgo or Leo, which is interesting given the fact that the Sphinx is a combination of a woman's head and a lion's body, the symbols for those two signs. Of course, that's no proof that it was built in this time. You could go around a whole other sidereal year and be back in this position and still have these two symbols in place. Next, incorporating sidereal calculations into the structure of the pyramid was done by orienting its various passages, especially the Grand Gallery and the ascending and descending passages, and what are called air shafts, in such a way that they are aligned with certain stars. Speculations as to the time of the pyramid's construction is determined by these alignments. The oval path in the other upper part of the illustration on the left shows the same path as the circle through the heavens on the right. Stars that have been and will again become Earth's North Star include Polaris, Thuban, Vega, Deneb, and Cephei. W. Harmon and HPB's date for precise alignment with Vega around 67,000 BC is somewhere around 2.5 times around this precessional circle from our current point. And they base that on the fact that that in Dendera, the astrological tableau there indicates a 3 times a precession around. Okay, next, if the casing stones were in position at the beginning of the 9th century, the so-called erosion marks upon the outside were not due to water. A good argument, suggesting that the casing stones would have protected the inner granite blocks from exposure. Next, the theory also that the salt upon the interior stones of the pyramid is evidence that the building was once submerged is weakened by the scientific fact that this kind of stone is subject to exudation of salt. While the building may have been submerged, at least in part, during the many thousands of years since its erection, the evidence adduced to prove this point is not conclusive. So we've already read about John Anthony West and Robert Schock's ideas on this subject. Their strongest argument is that there are other monuments built by this same material that is described here, that MPH describes, but that don't show the same erosion as the Sphinx and the pyramid.
Francis?
Yeah.
Martha asked, weren't Virgo and Leo one sign at some point?
That's true. At one point, there were 10 signs in the zodiac, and Virgo and Leo were a combined sign, which would, you know, be an even stronger symbolic indication for the Sphinx. Anyone else? Okay, cultural anthropologist Martin Gray also puts forward a compelling argument that the Great Pyramid was indeed submerged. Could we get a reader, please?
Yvonne, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. Still further evidence that the dynastic Egyptians did not construct the Great Pyramid of Giza may be found in sediments surrounding the base of the monument. In legends regarding watermarks on the stones halfway up its sides and in salt incrustations found within, silt sediments rising to 14 feet around the base of the pyramid contain many seashells and fossils that have been radiocarbon dated to be nearly 12,000 years old. These sediments could have been deposited in such great quantities only by a major sea flooding, an event the dynastic Egyptians could never have recorded because they were not living in the area until 8,000 years after the flood. This evidence alone suggests that the three main Giza pyramids are at least 12,000 years old. In support of this ancient flood scenario, mysterious legends and records tell of watermarks that were clearly visible on the limestone casing stones of the Great Pyramid, before those stones were removed by the Arabs. These watermarks were halfway up the sides of the pyramid, or about 400 feet above the present level of the Nile. Further, when the Great Pyramid was first opened, incrustations of salt an inch thick were found inside. While much of the salt is known to be natural exudation from the stones of the pyramid, chemical analysis has shown that some of the salt has a mineral content consistent with salt from the sea. These salt incrustations found at a height corresponding to the water level marks left on the exterior are further evidence that at some time in the distant past, the pyramid was submerged half up its height.
Okay, so here's another argument for that sort of 11,000 BC period. And notice that the arguments or hypotheses, I should say, that put the building back at like 68,000 BC are purely based on astronomical observation, right? And doing these calculations that suggest, for instance, that the inclination of the passages were precise, and air shafts and the Grand Gallery, those three especially, were in very specific alignment with, in particular, Vega back around 68,000 BC. Whereas this argument is, and the ones by Anthony West and Robert Schock are based on archaeological evidence of these salt incrustations and on the legends and records that talk about watermarks halfway up the Great Pyramid. So you have those two sources of that. In both cases, the argument is quite different than what Egyptologists put forth, that the pyramid was built in 4000 BC. Okay, any thoughts about this? This to me is one of the most convincing of the arguments, is this, this article by Martin Gray. Okay, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Kirsten, can you read that for us, please?
The Great Pyramid was built of limestone and granite throughout the two kinds of rock being combined in a peculiar and significant manner. The stones were trued with the utmost precision, and the cement used was of such remarkable quality that it is now practically as hard as the stone itself. The limestone blocks were sawed with bronze saws, the teeth of which were diamonds or other jewels. The chips from the stones were piled against the north side of the plateau on which the structure stands, where they form an additional buttress to aid in supporting the weight of the structure. The entire pyramid is an example of perfect orientation and actually squares the circle. This last is accomplished by dropping a vertical line from the apex of the pyramid to its baseline. If this vertical line be considered as the radius of an imaginary circle, the length of the circumference of such a circle will be found to equal the sum of the baselines of the four sides of the pyramid.
Thank you. So first, the Great Pyramid was built of limestone and granite throughout, the two kinds of rock being combined in peculiar and significant manner. We get more info on this from an article in Forbes magazine by David Bresson. Could we get a reader, please?
Eleanor, can you read that for us, please?
The Great Pyramid is made up from roughly 2.3 or 2.6 million blocks, carefully selected from various rock types. Most limestone rocks were quarried on the Giza Plateau. Following the natural layers of the limestone, it was relatively easy for the ancient stone cutters to exact the needed blocks. However, as the limestone displays a brownish-yellow color, not really appreciated at the time, it was used only for the inner supporting core of the pyramid. For the central chamber with the sarcophagus of the pharaoh, reddish-pink granite from Aswan was used, able to support the weight of the construction. White Tura limestone of the best quality was then used to cover the pyramid core made of less value Giza limestone. And that's from the article in Forbes magazine by David Bazan.
Thank you. Okay, among the most specific and significant symbolic uses of granite and limestone is the contrast of the materials used in the Queen's Chamber, so-called, which is made of limestone, and the King's Chamber, which is made of granite. Granite comes from magma formed by fire and is thus an apt metaphor for the spirit aspect, whereas the limestone of the Queen's Chamber is formed by precipitation from seawater, the primary agents being lime-secreting organisms, and is thus related to the feminine and form aspects. That said, the terms King and Queen's Chamber were given by the Arabs in relatively recent times. As mentioned earlier, these chambers were originally named after planets. Unfortunately, there's no record that survives to tell us which planet. We can speculate on that, but they certainly weren't originally called Queen's and King's Chamber.
Francis?
Yeah.
Kirsten says, the cement on the Great Pyramid in Bosnia is also stronger than that which we are able to make today. And this pyramid is about 29,200 years old.
Oh, that's interesting. Someone, it might have been Kirsten, that mentioned this pyramid before. In fact, I went looking for it. That's interesting. Yes, thanks for that. Okay. So next, the stones were trued with the utmost precision, and the cement used was such remarkable quality that it's now practically as hard as the stone itself. So could we get a reader for this short passage?
Ann Veronica, can you read that for us, please?
If one takes into account the problems of quarrying, roughing out, transporting over 2 million coarse stones, and finishing some 115,000 enormous casing stones to a precision of 1/100th of an inch, then raising, manipulating, and mortaring them into the correct place in a unified polished structure, one must agree with Antoniadi that the mind boggles at the enormity of the effort.
Thank you. Okay, next, the limestone blocks were sawed with bronze saws, the teeth of which were diamonds or other jewels. You know, just keep in mind, there's a lot of statements as though they were facts, and they're all conjectural. This is, a strong theory. There's occultists who believe the whole thing was done with directed sound, and there were no physical instruments used at all. So you have to consider many different hypotheses. Can we get a reader for this?
Kia, can you read that for us, please?
From a careful scrutiny of the coffer in the King's Chamber of Petri, established that ancients had used saws with 9-foot blades, their teeth made of hard jewels, to cut the sides of the coffer out of a single solid block. To hollow it out, they had used drills with fixed cutting points also made of hard jewels, probably diamond or corundum. Petri estimated that in order to cut through the hard granite, a pressure of 2 tons would have had to be placed on the drill. How this could be done was a mystery to Petri, who concluded, truth to tell, modern drill cores cannot hold a candle to the Egyptians. Their fine work shows the marks of such tools as we have only now reinvented. With such tools, the ancient Egyptians were somehow able to cut sharp hieroglyphs into incredibly hard diorite, and also to turn stone bowls to paper-thin surfaces. To measure the bottom of the coffer and to see if there were any secret opening beneath it, Petri had its 3 tons raised about 8 inches, but found no sign of an opening, any opening. When raised and struck, the coffer produced a deep, bell-like sound of extraordinary eerie beauty.
Thank you. This is the only description I've ever read of the fact that the sarcophagus is like a bell. I had that experience when I was in there. I was able to make it ring with this extraordinary resonant tone. You can't help but think that that wasn't part of the original purpose, to bring that sound in, you know. And why would you do that for a sarcophagus, just to bury a king? Also, you know, just look at how precise this cutting is. This is one solid block of one of the hardest types of granite that exists. And, you know, when you look at this, how it's like modern machinery. So it really does make you wonder if there weren't alternative methods, for instance, a mastery and an adept use of sound as a cutting tool, rather than these hypotheses of diamond tip drills, et cetera.
Francis?
Okay. Yeah.
Yvonne has her hand up.
Yes, Yvonne.
I was wondering how you made it sound.
I sounded an ohm, and as I was laying in there, and it just rang like a bell. In fact, the sound of it became louder than my own tone. And it was a quite transforming experience. I found myself penetrated throughout by this sound. It was really extraordinary. And of course, I wasn't expecting that. I hadn't heard anything. Like I said, this is the only other place I've ever read about this. None of the guidebooks mentioned this, right? I just laid in there and I thought I would sound the ohm, and there was this extraordinary response. If I'd known, I would have taken a pitch pipe and figured out just what tone it sounds at. That would be very illuminating.
So. That's beautiful. It makes you, think about, said God created the universe with sound.
It does, doesn't it? And at least, it also, the idea that this sarcophagus, quote unquote, this initiatory chamber, and it could well have been a kind of mock sarcophagus, with the idea being that you die to the outer world and that you're born again, a true second birth into soul infusion, or even higher, maybe, a vision of the monad, a third initiation kind of level, who knows, right? That took place in this sarcophagus. But
thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Anyone else? Okay, next up, the entire...
Yes.
Yeah.
Tia's got her hand up. Go ahead, Tia.
So considering the dating that MPH and HPV have for these pyramids, then they would have predated the actual onset or period that we recognize as the Egyptian period. Where we say that it was peopled by the so-called Egyptians.
By tens of thousands of years earlier. was the Menes was considered to be the first pharaoh, and also called the Aha was the first pharaoh, and that's put at something like 4500 BC. So, you know, HPB and MPH put the date back, you know, completely based on the alignment with Vega to about 68,000 BC, right? So that's in, you know, much, much, much further. There was no historical Egyptian kingdom at that, in that distant time.
So Francis, would that be a time of, would that be an Atlantean period that we are talking about?
Well, you know, Atlantis, the last island of Atlantis would have still been in existence.
And yeah.
If you go back that far, most of the Atlantean period would have passed.
Right. Because
Atlantis it was the whole global, it was a global root race, right? So okay. it wasn't just an island in the Atlantic, you know, with inhabitants. It was a whole root race, and that went back millions of years. So, you know, even at 68,000 BC would have been the end times of Atlantis. But the final sinking, according to Plato, wasn't 18,000 years BC, something like that.
Yeah, I was just thinking about who would be the, perhaps a question for MPH would, perhaps who would be the initiatory group that would have been using the pyramid in this way, you know, that we're talking about as a chamber. That would be my question. What's your thoughts?
It would have been the hierarchy as it existed at that time, you know, the Great White Brotherhood that guided, and you know, the whole story of Noah's Ark is very much connected with this. They were immigrants from Atlantis, you know. Especially the Samothracian mysteries really talk a lot about this ark and these seafarers that came from this distant land, right? And so it would have been those few who were guided out of Atlantis and went to Egypt that would have built under the guidance of the Great White Brotherhood of that time, would have built a pyramid basically to initiate a new root race and a new era, right? Of course, there were other initiates that went to other parts of the world. You know, Stonehenge is also considered to be a similar kind of an effect of those who came from Atlantis but migrated north, and then you have the whole Quetzalcoatl tradition and the Aztec Mayan culture that well, in the very beginning of this we looked at the we looked at that that papyrus that details the exodus from Atlantis to that part of the world. So, you know, each place had its tradition where the mysteries were reestablished. Anyone else? Okay, next up. The entire pyramid is an example of perfect orientation. Can we get a reader for this? This is fascinating.
Okay. Vivian, go ahead and ask your question, and then will you read, please?
Sorry, I'm a bit slow in putting up my hand, but
no problem.
Well, this subject is so interesting. Somebody mentioned the pyramid in Bosnia. I did actually go there many years ago, and the idea of the person who discovered it, who was Bosnian himself, Sam Osmanagić, was that it was at least 28,000 years old, proven by whatever dating. But they believed that it was, it produced a signal I can't think of the word, a Hertzian signal that went out through the point of that one pyramid, because there was a group of pyramids there too, but the pyramid of the sun. And the further it left out into outer space, the stronger it got. So it's very, very intriguing. I wouldn't be able to talk about it precisely at all. But yeah. And they also believe that underground there was the actual, whatever you call it, generator of the energy that was then sent out into wherever it was destined to go.
Fascinating.
Yes, it's very, very fascinating.
It doesn't get much press. You know, you don't hear much about it.
No, and if you read in Wikipedia, which is a place you shouldn't refer to for these kind of things, because the academic people or the Egyptians who believed that their pyramid was the greatest, which it probably was for other reasons, but the one in Bosnia was much bigger than the one in
It just in didn't survive intact in the same way that the Great Pyramid did. I think that's, isn't that correct? I remember looking at a picture of it and it's quite worn down, but you can clearly see the parameters of it.
Yes, and the alignment and everything is absolutely correct. It actually looked like a mountain.
Huh.
But I don't want to detract from your speaking of the Great Pyramid.
Oh, no, none of it detracts. It's all just part of it. You know, it's best when we have this kind of discussion. That's always more interesting.
And I think I do want to say that I did go into the King's Chamber many, many years ago with a group of people. And yeah. I knew very little about these things. And there were about 20 of us, I think, or 15 or 20. And at one stage, someone said, let us sound the Om. And I remember doing that and thinking, I dare not do this because it felt as if I was going to be lifted up off the ground and literally dematerialized. So I quickly stopped chanting the Om. I wasn't as brave as you, Francis.
Well, either that or you're just so much more sensitive that you had the good sense not to do it, you know. I'm definitely at the school of, you know, where angels fear to tread for good reason, you know. I go anyway. But
I wouldn't have known how to come back if that had happened.
Well, could you read this for us, please? Vivian, thank you.
Forget my duties. Sorry. For a structure that was built more than 4,000 years ago, long before the advent of blueprints and computers, the Great Pyramid of Giza is remarkably well aligned. Experts have long puzzled over how the Egyptians managed to construct this ancient wonder. Now, one engineer thinks he has discovered the secret to the pyramid's precision. The fall equinox. Glenn Dash, who has worked at archaeological sites in Egypt, Greece, Cyprus, and the United States, recently detailed his idea in the Journal of Ancient Egyptian Architecture. He notes that the Great Pyramid is nearly perfectly aligned along the cardinal points, north, south, east, and west, with an accuracy of better than 4 minutes of arc, or 1/15th of 1 degree. To demonstrate his theory, Dash set out with a rod, also known as a gnomon, for tracking the movement of the sun on September the 22nd, 2016, the day of the fall equinox. He planted the gnomon on a wooden platform and marked the location of the rod's shadow throughout the day, forming a curve. At the end of the day, he wrapped a piece of string around the pole and used it to mark an arc that intercepted 2 points of the curve. When a straight line is drawn through, it's almost perfectly pointed east to west, with a slight counterclockwise rotation, just like the alignment of Egypt's three biggest pyramids.
Interesting, huh? Okay. Finally.
Francis. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Eleonora says that Netflix Hancock, Ancient Apocalypse is a very interesting research.
Okay, good to know. Thank you for that's in the chat box, huh? Good, good, good.
Yes.
Okay, so finally, and actually squares the circle. So the proportions of the pyramid serve to square the circle. This last is accomplished by dropping a vertical line from the apex of the pyramid to its baseline. If this vertical line be considered as the radius of an imaginary circle, the length of the circumference of such a circle will be found to equal the sum of the baselines of the four sides of the pyramid. It might have been hard to follow, but we will look into that. So the fact that the Great Pyramid squares the circle, which is a philosophically very significant concept, and thus demonstrates pi through the relation of its height to its circumference, was first hypothesized by the author John Taylor and later proved on site through painstaking effort by Charles Piazzi Smythe. Let's take a closer look at this. Could we get a reader, please?
Scott, can you read that for us, please?
Along the face of the pyramid, Smythe checked the angle of the casing stones discovered by Howard Wies. Unfortunately, though sharp lines are already had already been almost obliterated by the Arabs and by the chipping away of souvenir hunters. But searching through the debris piled high around the base, Smythe was able to find fragments of casing stones with the angles still intact. Invariably, the angle checked out at about 52 degrees, or its complement of 128 degrees, confirming Taylor's theory that the height of the pyramid was designed to be in relation to the perimeter of its base, as the radius of a circle is to its circumference. To see if he could refine this angle, Smythe observed the silhouette of all the backing stones against the sky by means of a very accurate altitude azimuth circle. By this method, Smythe obtained the angle of 51 degrees, 49 minutes. Meanwhile, Sir John Herschel had obtained a figure of 51 degrees, 52 minutes from the dimensions of the casing stones, as reported by Howard Weiss. Smythe chose to take the mean of these available measures as 51 degrees, 51 minutes, 14.3 seconds, a difference of less than a minute from either figure. He also chose to take the mean of 763.62 feet or foot baseline measured by the French and the 764 feet measured by Howard Weiss and got 763.81, a difference of barely 2 inches on a length of 763 feet. There are the casing stones from the Great Pyramid that still survive.
Yeah, you can see there an angle there. They may have been found and reassembled since, you know, the time that Smythe was doing this work. He had to deal with a lot of rubble in his time. 51 degrees, 51 minutes.
Sounds familiar.
Okay, could we get a reader for this? Now, let me just real quickly describe what, or show by this illustration what DK was describing. DK, MPH, one of those guys. So you have the height of the pyramid here acts as the radius of this imaginary circle whose circumference equals the four sides of the pyramid. You get that? Therefore, the only possible way that can happen, or I should say, what determines that happening is this angle, which is 51 degrees, 51 minutes, right? At that angle, then the radius of this imaginary circle is equal to the four sides of the pyramids. Is that clear? So here's another shot of probably recently, or certainly after Smythe's time, reconstructed casing stones in, at their proper angle. So can we get a reader for this?
Okay, first, Jill's got her hand up.
Yeah, Jill.
I just don't want us to miss the fact that the 51.2 whatever degrees.
Yeah.
That's 1/7 of a circle. That means we got 7 points somewhere along the line.
I think it's 51.48, I think is a seventh. It's so close, isn't it? It's
yeah, right, it is.
That same ballpark. Yeah, good point. I'm glad you brought that up. That's a fact I used to know, and you reminded me. Thank you.
Okay,
can we get a reader, please?
Joe, do you want to read that for us, please?
Sure. This was an arbitrary act, but the result produced an astounding value for pi in the Great Pyramid proportions of 3.14159.
No, I interrupt you for a second. So the arbitrary act was all this measuring that took place here, right? They did all this measuring and they determined these lengths and angles, etc. And then they realized. So go ahead.
This was an arbitrary. Okay.
Then they realized that this came out to pi, right?
Right.
So go ahead.
Searching for a reason for the incorporation in the pyramid of this relation of the radius of a circle to its circumference, Smyth pursued Taylor's theory of the base being divided into 366 units to coincide with the number of days in the year. To have been absolutely precise, the perimeter should have measured 36,524.2 pyramid inches. This would require that each side be 9,140.18 British inches. The only solution appeared to be to dig up the sockets and remeasure the baseline more accurately, but time and money were running short. Fortunately, two engineers from Glasgow, Messrs. Inglis and Alton, happened to pass through Egypt on their way from a tour of the Holy Land. Cajoled by their fellow Scott, they agreed to help him uncover the sockets originally found by the French, which had once more become covered with debris in the intervening half century, and make a truly accurate survey. Following Smyth's complex computations, the engineers were able to uncover not only the sockets, but a perfectly leveled stretch of pavement at the perimeter of the base.
Thank you, Joe. And next, the final.
Andrea, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. Back in Scotland. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, back in Scotland, Piazzi Smythe received the results of the engineer's survey. These gave a much shorter length of 9,110 inches for a side of the pyramid. Smythe concluded that the true length must be the mean between this figure and the longer one of 9,168 inches, obtained by Howard Weiss, or 9,140 inches, which was just 1 inch less than was required for Smyth's theory, resulting in a year of 365.2 days instead of the precise 365.24 required by theory. A great deal now hung on the exactness of these figures. It could mean that the ancient Egyptians had produced a structure whose basic unit, the pyramid inch, incorporated not only a system for linear measurement with the cubit and the inch, but also for temporal measurement with a year of 365.24 days. Both based on the most sensible foundation, the polar axis of the planet, around which it rotates once in a day. In Smythe's opinion, the linear measure of the base of this colossal monument, viewed in the light of the philosophical connection between time and space, has yielded a standard measure of length, which is more admirably and learnedly earth-commensurable than anything which has ever yet entered into the mind of man to conceive. Smythe summed up his work: "The pyramid has created a more surprisingly accurate knowledge of high astronomical and geographical physics nearly 15,000 years earlier than the extremely infantile beginning of such things among the ancient Greeks."
Well, it's 1,500 years, but, you know, again, this is based on modern archaeological understanding of when the pyramid was built. So your era of 15,000 years may be more correct.
You are correct, Francis.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Okay. The fact that the Great Pyramid square the circle, wait a minute, hang on a sec. Okay, let's look back through these. So any question about these? The most, you know, there's two extraordinary pieces of data that come forth. This one is irrefutable, this squaring of the circle. I hope you all understand my explanation with the radius equaling the circumference of a circle that is equal to the four sides. And then the other is this length of the days in a year. You have to remember that there was, where did this come from? There was no data available for these measurements to be made. And later in Europe, there was gross error in this direction until much, much later calculations came into being. And even then, these calculations were much more accurate than what later occurred. As he says, much more accurate than among the Greeks. Okay, any thoughts or questions about this? If you...
Yeah, Joe has her hand up.
Yeah, Joe. Oh, you're muted, Joe. Are you there?
I want to point out that 51, 52, what was it, inches or feet?
Degrees.
That's very important in astrological calculations and actually brings us to a seven-pointed star. I can't make the connections in my own head, but I think it's equally as important as a five-pointed star.
Yeah, you really do have to wonder. I mean, it's extraordinary that the difference between squaring the circle in these pyramid measurements and the angle of a seven-pointed star are so close. They're like 3/100ths from each other, in pure math, right? And then to have constructed this edifice based on that is pretty extraordinary. So, go ahead, Joe.
One more point. It just occurred to me, because I do this, of course, but that this points to the sky, and it just gives humanity an access to fairly close accuracy in working with the sky.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
And, you know, in those days, there was a true understanding of the stars as great beings was recognized. And so this would have been a way, of course, it's all hypothetical, of bringing that energy in to the planet. You know, in a sense, the Great Pyramid is like a great symbol for connecting to these great, sorry, luminaries and the consciousness of them You know, it would be extraordinary to know the secret teachings that the building of the pyramid were based on. You know, what was its true purpose? If we accept that it's an initiation chamber, yes, but in terms of its initial alignment with these stars, whether Alpha Draconis or Vega or one of the other ones, what was known to be the connection between the initiations to take place and that starry alignment? You know, what, you know, it wasn't just, oh gee, let's line it up to this star. It's, there was some very powerful doctrine connected with that. Okay. If you want to know more, just read these three books and you can do a book report next time. Okay, next up, can we get a reader?
Martha, can you read that for us, please?
Yes, I'm here. If the passage leading to the King's Chamber and the Queen's Chamber was sealed up thousands of years before the Christian era, those later admitted into the pyramid mysteries must have received their initiations in subterranean galleries, now unknown. Without such galleries, there could have been no possible means of ingress or egress, since a single surface entrance was completely closed with casing stones. If not blocked by the mass of the Sphinx or concealed in some part of that image, the secret entrance may be either in one of the adjacent temples or upon the sides of the limestone plaza.
Thank you, Martha. So MPH makes an interesting point. If the Great Pyramid is as ancient as many believe it to be, and if it was sealed at the end of its construction, how could it have been used as a temple of initiation, except during the relatively brief years during its construction? So there's at least two possible answers. First, it wasn't actually sealed until millennia later, when some master determined that its time as a temple of initiation had finished. But even during this time, the functional door into the pyramid, possibly a swivel stone, would have been either guarded or unknown, except to that class of priests who used it. The second possibility is that there were, as MPH suggests, alternate secret entrances now unknown. But even in this case, the interior would have had to be open and available, not blocked, as it later was by huge granite plugs. So, you know, my opinion weighing in on this is that for that time that it could be guarded, and that the priests' craft and those initiations were taking place, it was open and available, that wasn't plugged. But then some great master, the end of that era came, and it was determined that it needed to be rendered, you know, made so that it couldn't be entered.
Francis?
Yeah.
Yvonne says that there's supposed to be an entrance under the paw of the Sphinx.
Yeah, that's they never found it. It's an idea that has been around forever. But you know, they've done some excavation there. You know, they had to pull away tons and tons of sand in order to release the Sphinx, and there was never anything found in that way. Of course, that doesn't mean that it isn't there somewhere a little further beyond what has been excavated. And also, you know, these things can be protected, occultly protected, so that they're not found until the hierarchy considers that humanity is ready for those discoveries. Okay, let's see, where are we here?
And Scott says, oops, hold on a minute here. Got a couple here. Going back to the pole star Vega.
Right.
Vega is the brightest star in the constellation of Lyra, represented in ancient Egypt and ancient India as a vulture or an eagle. The vulture was the symbol of Upper Egypt. The Egyptians believed that these birds were all females, created then by parthenogenesis, symbolized motherhood and purity, and also the cycle of death and rebirth.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a, you know, there's a further argument for the idea that the pyramid goes back that far. For me, the strongest argument is that HBB puts it forth, and therefore that writing, which was overshadowed by the masters, you know, came under the public eye. It's interesting, Scott. Yeah.
And then Vivian says,
constellation Lyra or Libra? What'd you say?
Lyra.
Yeah, Lyra.
L-Y-R-A.
Right.
The Lyra.
I said, yeah. Yes.
Okay, and Vivian says the Bosnia pyramid of the sun was blocked and made inoperative.
Right, as was the Great Pyramid at some point. Yeah, interesting. The parallels there, isn't it? Yeah, it's quite interesting. Anyone else? Okay.
No, I think that's all we got right now.
Okay, I think this is a good spot to stop because we're coming on time and we want to announce new times. And so there's a lot going on between now and next Sunday. We have a Treatise on Cosmic Fire webinar on Friday. And then also the following Friday. So they're back to back in order to avoid one happening on the 23rd, which is, you know, a lot of people, including myself, will be traveling at that time. So, and could you give dates? Is it the 18th for the Secret Doctrine? I'm not.
Let me see here.
It is.
Yes, December 18 at 8 p.m. GMT is the Secret Doctrine. And as we stand right now, the next Secret Teaching of All Ages will be 1 January at 8 p.m. GMT.
And that's, you know, keep your eyes, double check that. I have to clear that date with Tuya because before we can for sure say that date, but I'd say there's a 90% chance that it will happen at that time. Yeah, okay, that's it. So hope to see you on Friday for the Treatise on Cosmic Fire webinar. And thank you all for attending. I'll see you next time.
Goodbye, everybody.
Bye, thank you.
Thank you.